Welcome to the Strong Starts podcast with your hosts, Jessica Whitehead and Sarah Gerber-Kai.
Welcome back to the Strong Starts podcast. Thank you all for listening, subscribing, and for following us on social media. We are at Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube.
Yeah, Sarah, it's crazy that we are already recording our sixth episode. We even have listeners beyond our obligatory family members. People are watching our antics on social media, and we've even had requests for merch. We appreciate it, and we are excited to continue this journey with you.
Yes, we definitely appreciate it. And World Mental Health Day is coming up on October 10th, and in celebration of that day, which is dedicated to bringing awareness to mental health and reducing stigma, we're going to talk today about language and the power of our words.
Yes, we're going to talk about the language we use to talk about students, particularly students who may be neurodivergent. But really, these principles apply to all the different ways that we categorize and otherize students. Over time, there has been an increase in students receiving labels and diagnoses, which has impacted how we think and talk about students, how we set expectations, and how we educate students.
Yeah, you know, Jessica, I think my earliest memory of hearing an educator say something negative about a student was the first day of my first job in education. And she was telling me about one of the students that I was going to be working with. And she said, "It's like this student is possessed by the devil." And instead of being offended, I just felt nervous. Honestly, I thought, okay, so then there's no way I'm going to be able to help. This job is just impossible. I had this preconceived notion of the impact that I was going to be able to make or not make before I ever actually met the student.
Yeah, and we've probably all heard someone say something like that, or something like, "Oh, that kid's an eloper, get ready," or "That's a behavior kid, so they need another adult with them," or "They're a sensory kiddo, so they're going to struggle." You're right, Sarah. Once we award students that title, that's how they become defined. When in reality, a student may elope from a classroom, say 20 minutes one day, 15 minutes the next day, and 25 minutes the day after that. We're defining them as an eloper for leaving their space 5% of the school day. That means they successfully stayed where they were supposed to 95% of the time. We really do have to be careful about how we are defining students. I know plenty of staff members that don't meet expectations, myself included, 95% of the time.
Oh, yeah, me neither. Definitely not 95% of the time. And whether a student is given a label or we create that label, we have to be careful about how we're defining students.
Right. And I'm thinking about my own undesirable behaviors, and there's probably many of them, and how quickly I would be labeled. Sarah would agree that I'm, between the two of us, I'm the impulsive one or the unhinged one. And to be fair, I've had my moments. I'm sometimes grateful that she just sticks with me through it all. But when you look at the thousands of decisions I make every single day, only a tiny fraction are impulsive. But those few moments stand out and define me. People are quick to define us by our most notable flaws, turning a small part of who we are into our entire identity.
Well, yeah, once we define a student by their negative behavior, that behavior has a greater risk of becoming a reality, but also an excuse. So think about it. As a teacher, I might say something like, "Oh, hey, Jessica, I saw your student in the hallway." And Jessica might respond with, "Yeah, that's my eloper. They tend to do that. I just call the office and see if anybody can help." Or, "Oh, yeah, that student's a behavior kid. They always come back from recess like that." And I used to think that labels were really important. They were like this shortcut that gave us important information about how this student was going to learn best. Or they told us about that invisible backpack of trauma and lived experience that a student may enter the classroom with. Labels helped me to advocate for students. They justified the services and the behavior plans. But can we ever really not label students?
Probably not. The healthcare system will still need to diagnose children in order to bill insurance companies and deliver treatments, therapies, medication. Schools will still need to identify and label students to get them access to specialized instruction, special equipment, therapies. We're not going to be able to control that. But what we can control is the way we talk about students. There's a difference between the labels students are given for medical diagnoses, how those labels are used, and what labels we create. Are the labels we create giving us permission to set up low expectations? Do we lead discussions with talking about the label? Do we describe students as "he's the behavior kid" or "she is Miss Special Education Teacher's student"? Leading with the label becomes an excuse for poor educational outcomes. It rids us of the responsibility to update our practices in order to hold all students to high educational outcomes. it pushes that responsibility onto a doctor or a special education teacher, or even convinces us that the student is fundamentally incapable of ever achieving in the same way as their peers.
Yeah, and you know, language doesn't have to be sensational to be damaging to students. There's this famous study about the Pygmalion effect that was done by Rosenthal and Jacobson in 1965. And Rosenthal and Jacobson were testing out this idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy within the context of teachers and their class. They hypothesized that when teachers have high expectations for their students, those students will achieve more than students whose teachers don't have high expectations. They tested this out by telling a group of teachers that their students had been tested and could be expected to be what they called growth spurters, or students who were going to make above average growth in a year. But there was no test. There were no growth spurters. It was just a random group of students. And what happened was pretty remarkable. The students whose teachers expected them to be growth spurters increased their IQ by more points than the students whose teachers did not expect that of them. Just that teacher's mindset alone, that one variable, caused the students to make more growth than their peers. And 20 years later, another researcher named Brophy wanted to study the inverse. What happens if teachers have low expectations of their students? And the same was true. Low expectations led to low performance.
Sarah, I'm so glad you brought these studies because I found them fascinating. And when I think about it, it kind of makes sense. If you expect a student to do really well in a year and they're not understanding something you're teaching, you're probably going to try harder to change your approach until they do understand it. Whereas if you have a random class of students, you're probably just going to assume that due to the nature of differences between kids, some students will understand the material and some won't, but that's just the way it is. You're going to be less likely to reflect on your own practice and make changes. There's one quote that resonates with me. It's easy to spot a yellow car when you are always thinking of a yellow car. It's easy to spot opportunity when you are always thinking of opportunity. It's easy to spot reasons to be mad when you are always thinking of being mad. Watch yourself. And that's written by an unknown author, but used often. But when we mentally label a student as an eloper or as a behavior kid, we're essentially putting on eloper glasses. We start to see every moment they're out of their seat as proof of the label, even if it's just to sharpen their pencil. We're not looking for opportunities to praise them for staying in their seat 95% of the time. We are only looking for reasons to be frustrated, and our mind finds them. This is why we have to be so intentional about the language we use.
Well, yeah, and this phenomenon is very human. We're always trying to organize and make sense of what's happening around us. So we start to see patterns even when they don't exist. And the same is true of behavior, like you said, Jessica. When we're told that a child has ADHD and isn't medicated, we might start to see every inattentive or busy behavior as a result of that label. When in fact, there might be something about the way that the classroom is set up or our instructional strategies that's causing that behavior. Behavior principles don't just cease to apply when a student has a label. We may even use that label or that behavior or diagnosis as an excuse to not change our practices.
And sometimes labels give us empathy. We see the behavior and feel frustrated, but then knowing there's a label, a diagnosis, a trauma history, it suddenly gives us the empathy to give the student some grace for their behavior. However, sometimes the empathy doesn't come until after the label. I want to emphasize the sometimes because I don't want to say that everyone does this and make it, you know, definite. But there are times when we just get frustrated with a student. Oh my gosh, Sarah keeps hiding under that table and I just can't figure out why. She needs to stay out from under there. But then we later learn about Sarah's trauma history and learn that hiding is a trauma response. So we are understanding of her behavior and we even let her stay under the table as long as she is being safe.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you bring this up because empathy is important. We want our teachers to have empathy. There was an interesting study done about the relationship between empathy and stringency of punishment. The hypothesis was that mock jurors with higher empathy are going to be more lenient on a defendant during their sentencing. And that hypothesis was confirmed by this study. Mock jurors with higher empathy delivered shorter sentences than mock jurors with lower empathy. And so there's a possibility that this same association is happening with how we treat our kids. Are we more lenient towards students that we can relate with? And if so, then the effects of labeling might even have the potential to be more harmful, because what we do when we label is we're marking students as other. We're putting more distance between a student's experience and a teacher's experience by talking about them in terms of inherent differences.
And I've often wondered if empathy, when it comes to student labels, is a double-edged sword. Do we use a label to justify lowering our expectations for a student, or does it challenge us to raise our expectations for ourselves? Let's say I have a student with a learning disability and reading and get support in writing. My goal is for them to comprehend articles and write a 5-paragraph essay. But instead of lowering the bar, my empathy leads me to adapt. I might provide accommodations like a graphic organizer, speech to text, to ensure that they meet the same high expectations. They might just take a different path than their peers. The same principle applies to behavior. If a student tends to elope when frustrated, my expectation isn't for them to stay seated no matter what. I modify my approach by providing a break pass or a personal calm down space, or a different space in the room for them to go. I'm not lowering the bar, but empowering the student with the tools they need to reach it. Empathy creates a realistic path for every student to meet high expectations. That empathy doesn't have to come after the diagnosis or the label. It can come before.
Definitely. So let's paint a picture of how this is going to look. Let's say it's the start of the school year and we want to start off strong. We have our accountability systems in place. We feel supported. We feel optimistic. We're resilient. How are we going to start the school year so that the way we talk about students reflects our high expectations of them? And part of this comes with how we're documenting what it is that they need. So in schools that write notes on students so that the next year's teacher has some idea of who each student is that's coming into their classroom, the language that we use when writing these notes is really important. A strong start would be writing these notes in terms of what I, as the educator, need to do in order to see high growth from that student. Think about it. In Rosenthal and Jacobson's study, those teachers in the experiment group all started the year believing that their students had this above average potential for intellectual growth. And that caused the teachers to adjust their practices throughout the school year in order to make that growth a reality. Those students didn't actually have any unique potential for growth. It was just a random group of kids. It was their teachers' belief in them that was the variable that led to that higher growth.
Okay, Sarah, but not every single document can be framed in terms of expectations of the teacher. What about IEPs, discipline referrals, medical notes, and any other papers and documents that come in students' files?
Yeah, you're right, Jessica. We can't control all forms of documentation. You know, when I was a therapist intern, I had this supervisor who gave me a really great piece of advice. She would hand me a client's file from their last therapist and say, "Don't look at this until you've had at least one session." She knew that what I was going to read in that file was going to alter my expectations for how that session would go. But she also trusted that I had the wherewithal and the skill set to be able to navigate that first session and assess the tools that I was going to need in order to help that client get to their goals. Collectively, educators, we have the skills. Collectively, we have the knowledge. If we don't have it, we're going to find a coach or an online class that's going to teach us what we need to know. We need to start our year with the expectation that we will be able to do what has to be done for our students to meet our high expectations, regardless of what's in that file.
And I like how you phrase this in terms of the collective, because that's an important use of language for the start of the year as well. Jessica isn't just Miss Sarah's student, she's our student. If Miss Sarah doesn't have the skills to get Jessica to reach the mountain just yet, there's a whole school around Jessica that is just as responsible for getting her to the top of that mountain. We have to stop trying to shift blame and start taking collective responsibility for the outcome of our students. The way we talk about our students matters. Whether labels are created by us or given by a diagnosis can either become a self-fulfilling prophecy of low expectations or a tool for shared responsibility and growth.
Yeah, it all comes down to mindset. We can choose to see our students as other, defined by a label or a moment of frustration, or we can choose to see them as ours. They are our kids. And if one of our kids needs support, we as a collective have the skills and the responsibility to provide it.
Yeah, it's a simple choice. Do we use labels to take responsibility off of our shoulders, or do we use our language to take shared responsibility? We have the power to stop letting labels define students and start thinking of them as our kids. Language is powerful. Let's use it to lift up our students, not to define them by their struggles. let's stop shifting blame and start taking collective responsibility for their outcomes. And that's a great note for us to end on. So until next time, thanks for listening. Make sure you subscribe wherever you get podcasts and follow us at Strong Starts Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube.
Bye, everybody.